The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Carroll. Continued, Cassette 11, Side 1. In a motorcade led by police cars filled with dozens of Sheriff Kilday's deputies, and by jeeps bearing immense photographs of himself, driven by uniformed war veterans, Johnson rode through San Antonio sitting atop the back seat of a convertible, with the Kilday, Congressman Paul, flanking him on one side, and Kilday's deadliest enemy, former Mayor Maury Maverick, flanking him on the other, symbolizing the fact that he had the support of both sides in the city's political wars. On his first 2 days in San Antonio, however, Johnson's most significant activities were not public, but private. Quiet meetings with leaders in that same Plaza Hotel in which, 14 years before, he had sat in a room buying votes with $5 bills. In this election, Lyndon Johnson was going to run the West Side personally. Johnson had been scheduled to vote in Johnson City on Election Day and then go to his Austin headquarters, but instead he spent the day, his third that week, in San Antonio. He was riding the polls on the West Side, on that West Side where they just stuffed the ballots in there, on that West Side where, after polls closed, some poll watchers were paid to leave, and doors were locked, and levers were pulled on voting machines. One of his middlemen, the city's street commissioner, Jimmy Knight, was to recall that Johnson gave him $1,000 in $1 bills for the expenses. Don't misunderstand me, it's not a payoff or anything, of poll watchers, because he, Lyndon Johnson, wanted to go around the polls, and if the candidate gives the money, it has to be more. The price goes down immediately if somebody else but the candidate gives it to him, and the satisfaction is just as great. So as Johnson jumped out of his car at each polling place and walked among his workers, urging them on, the street commissioner followed him, handing out expense money. You happen to inadvertently put your hands in your pocket and give him a couple of dollars and move on, you understand. You take this and put $10, $15, $20 and put this in the crowd. If there was a touch of legitimacy to such expense money, with other amounts of money handed out by the Johnson entourage in San Antonio that day, the touch was less perceptible, and the amounts were much larger. And with the candidate's eye on them, Owen Kilday's deputies earned their money. All day they patrolled the West Side, looking not for crime, but for votes. All that broiling hot election day, Lyndon Johnson, with John Connolly at his side, rode the polls in San Antonio. And only then did he drive to Johnson City to cast his own vote, ballot number 353, in the Blanco County Courthouse, 2 blocks from the house in which he had spent his youth after his father had lost the Johnson Ranch. South of San Antonio, in Alice, in Jim Wells County, Indio Salas, after a stop at the Election Day tent that had been erected across from the Precinct 13 polling place in the Nayer School, arrived at the school ready for trouble from the reformers' poll watchers. But, he was to write, this time had no trouble. They just sit in the place designated by me. 2 chairs on the far side of the schoolroom, too far away to see the ballots. When the polls closed and Salas began to count the ballots, unfolding them and calling out a name to his 3 clerks, Jimmy Holmgreen felt that the election judge was counting for Johnson ballots that had actually been cast for Stevenson. And he was right. If they were not for our party, I make them for our party, Salas was to reveal almost 40 years later. But when Holmgreen jumped up and approached the table, Salas snarled at him, you stay away from that desk. You sit over there. Sit down and don't interfere with my clerks. Holmgreen, not eager for another encounter with the huge Deputy Meisenheimer, sat down. Salas and his clerks resumed calling out the votes. Johnson, Johnson, Johnson. No election day tents had been erected in neighboring Duval County. George Parr didn't need to make any preparations. He was just waiting for the telephone to ring to find out how many votes Lyndon Johnson needed. The early returns came mostly from 3 of the state's 4 big cities, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth, because voting machines were in use in these cities, and they gave Stevenson a lead of more than 20,000 votes. Returns from the 4th big city that used machines, San Antonio, were unexpectedly slow, but the young men in the Hancock House, and indeed almost all observers, anticipated that when these returns came in, they would substantially increase Stevenson's lead. The young men were sure that their chief had been defeated. Lady Bird told a friend, well, it looks like we've lost. I guess we'll have to work real hard in the radio business now. Stevenson drove to his ranch with a group of old friends to sit by the South Llano, listen to the falls, reminisce over old victories, and celebrate this new one. But neither Lady Bird nor the young men knew what the men in the Brown Building knew, nor did Coke Stevenson. He had defeated Johnson by 11,000 votes, a 2-1 margin, in San Antonio in the first primary, but when late that evening the returns from San Antonio finally came in, he had not beaten him by a 2-1 margin this time. He hadn't beaten him at all. Johnson had beaten him. Kilday's deputies and Dan Quill had done their job. Provide enough money, Quill had promised, and the West Side could be delivered. It was, and so was the adjoining black area. Some 10,000 Johnson votes had been produced in this vast slum, and despite Stevenson's previous popularity in San Antonio, the city's total vote this time was Stevenson, 15,511, Johnson, 15,610. A remarkable turnaround, one observer was to comment. And by that time, the valley was being heard from. It was heard from all that evening, for the most part late that evening. Stevenson's lead was holding at 17,000 votes, and then Webb County reported 5,554 for Johnson, 1,179 for Stevenson, almost a 5-1 margin, and a plurality of more than 4,000 votes for Johnson. Judge Raymond had delivered. New returns from Hidalgo County gave Johnson a plurality of almost 3,000 more. Cameron County's new returns pulled him 1,700 votes closer. Then Nueces County was heard from, a gain of 3,400 votes. And those were the counties with cities, and in some precincts at least, voting machines. That evening, returns were coming in also from the valley's isolated rural counties, controlled by George Parr. In Precinct 13 in Jim Wells County, Salas had counted well. In previous elections, he had given the favored candidate 80% of the vote. This time, he had given Johnson more than 90%, 765-60. Thanks largely to that single precinct, Jim Wells County had given Johnson a total of 1,788 votes to Stevenson's 769. In the other rural counties, where there was no reform strength to speak of, Parr had been able to count him as he wanted. Brooks County reported 408 for Johnson, 110 for Stevenson. In Zapata, it was 711 for Johnson, 158 for Stevenson. In Jim Hogg, 723-198. But even such overwhelming margins paled before the returns from the two counties in which George Parr's control was absolute. In Starr County, it was 2,908 for Johnson, 166 for Stevenson. And in Duval, Parr's home county, it was 4,195 for Johnson, 38 for Stevenson, a margin of more than 100-1. When the Texas Election Bureau closed for the night at 1:30 a.m., out of almost 1 million votes cast, Stevenson led by only 854. But he led, and most of the votes were in. The next 3 days, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, would be days of wild confusion. They always were in close Texas elections. Nearly 1 million votes had been cast, most of them on paper ballots. The judges counting them on election day in the precincts were often doing so with representatives of both sides looking over their shoulders and urging them to greater speed, interrupting them with arguments and with pleas for the latest totals. Then the totals were sent in by telephone, or by telephoning Western Union, whose operators also made mistakes, and were recorded at the Texas Election Bureau in a hectic election night scene. One common error was transposition of the two candidates' votes, because some lists had Stevenson's name first, others Johnson's. Transpositions, however, were merely one out of many possibilities for error. In counting, copying, and tabulating, the votes passed through the hands of 8 different groups between the voter and the final declared result, the State Observer noted. With 1 million votes running the gauntlet of the human element 8 different times, there will always be mistakes regardless of the honesty and good intentions of the humans involved. Few persons familiar with Texas politics, though, were confident of the universality of honesty and good intentions. There was common knowledge in the upper levels of Texas politics of the precincts that were for sale, the boxes in which the county judge wouldn't bring in the box, report the precinct totals to the election bureau, until the man who had paid him told him what he wanted that total to be. In close elections, precinct results were altered all through the state. Coke Stevenson's supporters included men who were veterans at these practices, and although they had been careless before Election Day, having neglected the preparations needed to assure that the recounting would be in their favor, they were working frantically now, and they were on the alert against Johnson's attempt to do the same thing. An axiom of Texas politics held that the lead in the runoff always wins. In other words, the candidate ahead by the end of Election Day, at which time most of the vote had been counted, almost invariably won because he could hold out, delay reporting, enough boxes to keep a reserve to counter changes made by the other side. Since both sides were changing votes, the side with the lead could keep the lead by changing enough votes to offset the other side's changes. Perhaps the only instance in modern Texas political history in which this rule had been broken was Lyndon Johnson's 1941 race, when he had, through overconfidence, allowed all his boxes to be reported early, thereby revealing how many votes his opponent needed to add, and foreclosing his chance to add any more of his own. Now, in the areas of Johnson's greatest strength, those whose votes had made the election close, observers felt he was again foreclosed. San Antonio voted by machine, and those mechanically recorded tallies had been officially certified, and few changes were possible. And as the dean of Texas political reporters, Alan Duckworth, was to write about Duval County, but in words applicable to the valley as a whole, Duval always votes overwhelmingly, one way or the other, but the county usually reports practically complete on election night. On Sunday, with Stevenson in the lead, his supporters were telephoning to election judges who had not yet reported their boxes to keep them out until they saw what Johnson would do, and they were confident that they could offset any move Johnson could make. The block vote that Lyndon Johnson received with the help of the men in the Brown Building was substantial even for Texas. In the counties where George Parr just counted them, Duval, Starr, LaSalle, Jim Hogg, Zapata, and Brooks, the total reported on Election Day was 10,323 for Johnson, 1,329 for Stevenson, a plurality for Johnson of almost 9,000 votes. To that plurality could be added the 700 votes from Box 13 in Jim Wells County. Parr controlled Mextown and Niggertown in Corpus Christi, added another 3,000 votes to Johnson's advantage. And these were not the only ethnic votes that Johnson received from the area bordering the Rio Grande. He came out of the valley, an area that included not only Webb County, where Judge Raymond just wrote down what he wanted, and the six counties in Parr's domain, but also Cameron, Hidalgo, Dimmitt, Maverick, and Nueces, with a margin of more than 27,000. The remarkable turnaround in San Antonio was achieved through the 10,000 votes he received in ethnic areas. Although key officials in both camps say that 10,000 was the number of votes controlled on Johnson's behalf in that city, the number of votes that were, in a term euphemistically used by these officials, changed over between the two primaries, is only about 8,000. Even if the lower 8,000 figure is used, however, that figure, added to the valley's 27,000 plurality, means that Johnson's plurality from the block totaled 35,000 votes. If his total was impressive, his percentages were more so. In Duval County, Lyndon Johnson received 99% of the vote. In the six counties of George Parr's domain combined, he received 93%. He was given 82% of the vote in Judge Raymond's Webb County. In the key Mexican-American and black sections of Corpus Christi, his percentage was 80%. In each of these areas, in other words, at least four out of every five voters voted for him. So he received a 35,000 vote plurality from areas in which the voting pattern was dramatically out of keeping with the normal patterns in a democracy. How much of that 35,000 vote edge can be said to have been bought, either by payments to jefes and other political bosses who wrote down voting totals with little or no reference to the actual votes that had been cast, or by payments to bosses who rounded up men and women and made sure they voted as they were told to, or by payments to election judges who counted for Johnson votes that had actually been cast for Stevenson, or by payments to individual voters who voted in accordance with the payment they received, or by payments to deputy sheriffs who transported to the polls and directed the voting of men and women who did not even know whom they were voting for. How many of those votes were bought, and how many would have been cast for Lyndon Johnson even had no money changed hands, cannot, after 40 years, be determined. But from the descriptions given by men familiar with the voting in the valley and on the west side that election day in 1948, it is apparent that the overwhelming majority of those votes, not merely thousands of votes but tens of thousands, fall into that category. The dramatic disparity between the returns from the West Side and the Valley and the returns from the rest of Texas indicates the disproportionate significance that this area played in the election. Coke Stevenson carried three counties in the state by a margin of at least 80%, two of them so tiny as to be of almost no significance in the election. In one, Kennedy County, the vote was 52-8, and in the other, Roberts County, it was 181-12. The third county was Gillespie, where the Johnson Ranch is located. Gillespie gave Stevenson 80% of its vote, 1,014-250. These three counties produced for Stevenson a plurality not of 35,000 votes, but of 977. They were a minor factor in the election. Johnson's block voting was a major factor, the decisive factor. Without that plurality from the West Side and the Valley, he would have trailed Stevenson by a substantial margin. Despite Johnson's harvest of these votes, however, he was still behind. His months of ceaseless campaigning and his injection into the Texas political scene of unprecedented amounts of money had narrowed the huge advantage which Coke Stevenson had enjoyed at the beginning of the long campaign and had brought him within striking distance of Mr. Texas. His purchased votes had brought him almost even, but he was still behind by 854 votes, and the men in the Brown building feared that Stevenson was likely to increase his lead during the blizzard of corrections, honest mistakes, and normal Texas recounting that were to come. And if their own candidate didn't make up that narrow margin, his loss would be as final as if he had lost by 100,000. Lyndon Johnson's political career was all but over for want of fewer than 1,000 votes. The Election Bureau closed at 1:30 a.m. Lady Bird begged Lyndon to get some sleep. He went into the bedroom and changed into pajamas, but a few minutes later he burst out, his hair as wild as his eyes. He spent the night in the little paneled den of the Dillman Street house, still in his pajamas, pacing back and forth or sprawled across the daybed, and a telephone was always in his hand. In the Brown building, Alvin Wirtz and Everett Looney were telephoning, too. Ed Clark was calling from his home. Lyndon Johnson had tried to buy a state, and although he had paid the highest price in Texas history, he had failed. So, now he was trying to steal it. The telephone calls were to local Johnson managers in thousands of precincts all across Texas. Some of the calls were to ask the managers to be vigilant against any Stevenson attempt to steal votes in their counties. But other calls had a different purpose. The local managers were being asked to recheck, and in the rechecking, to find a few more votes for Johnson. So far as can be learned, or at least proven, 40 years later, Johnson personally made no telephone request that votes be added to his totals. Clark explains that the men in the Brown building did not want the candidate to make such requests himself. When questioned as to whether that was because Johnson might be asked if he had called, Clark nodded. Rather, the purpose of Johnson's calls was to reassure the local leaders that they would be with the winner when all the votes had been counted, and to give them a sense of personal contact with the candidate. We weren't asking him to say anything illegal, but it was important that he give them recognition, that he tell them everything was going to be okay, Clark says, because we still needed them to validate their votes, to stand behind them. Of course, it was not necessary for Johnson to make requests himself. Others were making them on his behalf. Some of the men who received these calls replied that technological considerations prevented them from helping. In San Antonio, Sheriff Kilday's chief deputy, George Huntress, received a telephone call from the Johnson camp inquiring into the possibility of additional votes. Huntress reminded the person inquiring that San Antonio now used voting machines and that the results had been recorded. For other recipients of these calls, the considerations were ethical. The Johnson man who took the call in San Marcos replied that, of course, he couldn't find any more votes. The election was over. But other calls went to a more receptive man, a man who could find not just a few more votes, but a few hundred more. A politician in San Diego, county seat of Duval, who took one of those calls remembers, "It was Lyndon Johnson's office. It was very important that they get hold of George." Early Sunday morning, a rumor began to circulate in Austin, and later that morning the rumor was confirmed. The Valley had already done a lot for Lyndon Johnson. 27,000 vote plurality. But the Valley was going to do more. In particular, George Parr was going to do more. The Duke of Duval had given Lyndon Johnson a 100-1 plurality, more than 4,000 votes in his county alone. Now on Sunday, with Johnson behind, despite the Duke's efforts, Duval County announced that there were more votes from the county to come. It had just been discovered, Barr's election officials told the Texas Election Bureau, that the returns from one of Duval County's precincts had not yet been counted. It was hoped to have them later in the day. Out on the banks of the South Llano, over a telephone that had been installed on a tree for election night, Stevenson had been hearing rumors of the Johnson camp's maneuvers. Confirmation came from one of his county managers in the Panhandle, who told the former governor that he had just received a telephone call from someone in Johnson's headquarters who was under the impression that he was Johnson's county manager, and who had asked him if he couldn't change at least 3 votes. That was how we first learned what Lyndon was doing, Ernest Boyette recalls. When he was behind, he got on the telephone to his managers around the state and asked them if they couldn't change votes. Stevenson remained calm. He might not be participating in or even aware of what his own allies might be doing in Austin, but he was certainly aware that such maneuvering was within the normal parameters of Texas politics. But then, early Sunday morning, he heard about the Duval announcement, which went beyond the parameters. Stevenson and his advisers understood at once the significance not only of the fact that Parr was announcing that new votes would be coming in from the valley, but of the fact that now, more than 12 hours after the polls had closed, these votes had not yet been counted, so that no one could tell how many each candidate had received. In later years, Johnson aides would argue that such a late finding of votes in the valley was customary in Texas politics, but it wasn't. As Alan Duckworth wrote in the Dallas News that day, the thing that brought protest from the Stevenson camp was the lateness of Duval's final report this time. The county usually reports practically complete on election night. George Norris Green, whose book The Establishment in Texas Politics analyzes Texas elections in the 1940s, notes that Stevenson had won the valley vote in his previous races, but comments that all of those votes had at least been turned in on time. Since few constraints limited Parr in the number of votes he reported, he just counted them, the effect of his turning in votes late would be that he could report almost any number of votes needed, which would mean that to a considerable extent, the Duke of Duval could decide the result of any close statewide election all by himself, that the only limit would be the number of poll taxes he had paid. The 27,000-vote margin already given to Lyndon Johnson by the Duke of Duval and his allies in the valley hadn't been enough to elect Johnson. So now, this Sunday, what really was George Parr doing but just waiting to see how many more votes would be needed? Jumping into his car, Stevenson accelerated so fast that he left a plume of dust behind him as he sped to Austin. But there was nothing he could do once he got there. All day Sunday, the Election Bureau was inundated in the usual blizzard of vote changes from all over the state, a few large, most small, but all day, looming over the counting of these ballots, was that missing box down in the valley. For Coke Stevenson, Duckworth wrote, the news came at dusk Sunday. It was bad, as expected. And it came at a strategic moment. All day, minor changes had in general balanced themselves out, and Stevenson had stayed ahead by approximately the same 800-vote margin. Then, about 7 o'clock, 24 hours after the polls had closed, upward revisions for Johnson came in from several Houston precincts, revisions in themselves so suspicious that there were immediate calls for an investigation. Suddenly, Stevenson was leading by a bare handful of votes. And then, at this crucial point, Duval announced that it now had its returns ready. The vote it had reported on Saturday night had been 4,195 for Johnson, 38 for Stevenson. Now Duval election officials said that there had been 427 previously unreported votes in that uncounted precinct. Stevenson, they said, had received 2 of them. Johnson had received 425. 425 new votes, Duval's count was now Johnson 4,620, Stevenson 40, and for the first time, Stevenson was no longer ahead in the statewide totals. In the closest major race in the state's long political history, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported, Lyndon Johnson rode into the lead of the U.S. Senate race Sunday night on a sudden tide of votes from Duval County. No newspaper commented on a remarkable aspect of the Duval vote. Since another 2 votes would later be found there for Johnson, making Duval's final vote 4,622 to 40, 4,662 persons thus voted in a county in which only 4,679 poll tax receipts had been issued. The 99.6% turnout was an astonishing display of civic responsibility. On Monday, however, the Election Bureau received in the mail written returns from counties that had previously reported over the telephone, and there were the usual corrections made necessary by transpositions, discoveries of double counting, and simple mistakes in arithmetic, as well as perhaps other kinds of mistakes. But Monday brought only one new return from the Valley, 80 new votes for Lyndon Johnson in Starr County. Final returns from Starr were Johnson 3,038, Stevenson 170. Parr's two key counties alone therefore gave Johnson an edge of more than 7,000 votes, 7,660 to 210. And Stevenson received more benefits from the corrections than Johnson. Hour after hour all that day and into the evening, Johnson worked the telephone in his den, alternately sprawled, half-reclining, on the daybed and pacing back and forth across the little room, telephone in hand, lighting one cigarette from the end of another, the skin on his gaunt face drawing tighter and tighter, the circles under his eyes growing darker and darker. A candidate by El Greco. But by the end of the day, Stevenson had 494,396 votes. Johnson had 494,277. Stevenson led by 119 votes in what Duckworth, in a view echoed in newspapers throughout the state, wrote was the most exciting Senate race Texas has ever known. Tuesday brought more transpositions, including a sizable one from Eastland County in West Texas. When someone at the Bureau rechecked Eastland's 2,645 to 2,317 figures, which had had the higher figure in Johnson's column and the lower in Stevenson's, it was found that they should in fact have been reversed, and that change pushed Stevenson further ahead. And under Texas election law, 7 p.m. Tuesday, 72 hours after the polls closed, was the deadline for precinct election judges to turn over to their county chairman all ballot boxes containing not only the actual ballots that voters had cast, but the tally and poll sheets kept by election judges and clerks. But that hour, the Election Bureau announced it had complete in the sense that all boxes had reported, returns in all of the state's 254 counties, except for one box in sparsely populated Borden County, where about 40 votes were supposed to be still unreported. And, of course, except for the two Stevenson counties, Hansford and Kinney, which hadn't held primaries because Stevenson's men had not considered them necessary. At 7, the Election Bureau announced its final returns for the day. Stevenson, with 494,555 votes, was 349 votes ahead of Johnson, who had 494,206. Election Bureau manager Bob Johnson told a reporter that there was little doubt the Bureau's unofficial count would give Stevenson a majority. And as the Houston Chronicle pointed out, the Election Bureau, although it cannot actually elect an officeholder on the basis of its unofficial returns, has been consistently accurate during the 32 years of its existence. It has never missed naming the eventual winner. Indeed, the returns from each county had been checked and rechecked so many times by both sides that no further major changes were expected. Lyndon Johnson's second Senate race apparently had ended like the first. Should Johnson lose by a few hundred votes, as Duckworth wrote, it would be the second time he has been nosed out on his quest for a seat in the upper house. The blaring headlines, Stevenson leads by 349 with about 40 votes out, seemed to trumpet the death of his dreams. Little change in the situation occurred on Wednesday, September 1st, the fourth day after the election. A day of checking and rechecking returns produced only 17 revisions, most of them downward because of discoveries of double counting, and these were so evenly divided between the two candidates that they virtually canceled themselves out, producing a net change of only 13 votes. These were in Stevenson's favor, and his lead increased to 362 votes. Stevenson's margin firm, a typical headline said, and the vote in the race for United States Senator from Texas seemed to have all but hardened into its final form. Little change occurred on Thursday, the fifth day after the election. 11 revisions reduced Stevenson's lead by a total of 11 votes to 351. Many newspapers were treating the race as over. Stevenson holds final vote lead, said the Brownsville Herald. His supporters exulted. In an editorial entitled Good Senator by Bad Margin, the Dallas News said that Texas has made a good senatorial choice. It is a remarkable victory when it is clearly in the face of what, in mere politeness, may be termed block voting in four southwest Texas counties. Duval County had come quite close to being represented in Congress by a senator of its own. Reporters found Stevenson at the Travis County Courthouse, performing legal work for a rancher who was his neighbor in Kimball County. Pressed for a statement, he said that all the counties have been rechecked carefully. He was sure he had won. Stevenson's feelings were echoed by even the most cautious Texas politicians. The election seemed to be over. But their feelings were incorrect. The Valley wasn't done yet. On Friday, September 3rd, the sixth day after the election, the Valley was heard from again. Hardly had the Election Bureau opened at 9 when corrections were reported from the Rio Grande. 43 new votes for Johnson from Dimmitt County, 38 new votes for Johnson from Cameron County. In particular, George Parr wasn't done. With Duval County poll taxes exhausted, no more votes could be produced in that county, of course, but there were other counties in his domain. One was Zapata, and Friday morning Zapata produced 45 votes more for Johnson. Corrections came in from counties in other areas of the state that Friday morning, but all were small, none as big as those from the three Valley counties. At noon, the Valley's 126 new votes had played the major role in reducing Coke Stevenson's lead to 157 votes, 494,096 to 493,939. Another county in Parr's domain was Jim Wells, where the reformers' strength had forced Parr to exercise discretion on Election Day. The only precinct in that county that had been run as the Duke liked precincts run was Luis Salas's Precinct 13. The vote reported by Salas on election night, 765 to 60 in Johnson's favor, had provided the bulk of Johnson's 1,788 to 769 margin in Jim Wells. Now on Friday morning, the Democratic Executive Committee of Jim Wells County was meeting to make its final certification of the returns and report them to the state committee. In the county courthouse, one of the committee members, B.M. Brownlee, was unfolding the tally sheets and reading off the totals. The totals for the first 12 precincts were the same as those that had been reported on election night. Then Brownlee unfolded the tally sheet for Salas's Precinct 13. This total was not the same. The figure for Johnson, which had been reported as 765 on election night, was now 965, because, according to testimony that would later be given, someone had, since election night, added a loop to the 7 to change it into a 9. Johnson had 200 more votes. At about 12:30 p.m. on Friday, with Stevenson's lead holding at 157 votes, Jim Wells County telephoned its amended return, including those 200 additional Johnson votes, to the Election Bureau. And suddenly, with virtually all the counting in the election over, Coke Stevenson was no longer ahead. Lyndon Johnson was ahead. With so few counties still to be reported, and only minor remaining changes to be made, those 200 votes from Precinct 13 were decisive. In the Bureau's final tabulations, Johnson had 494,191 votes, Stevenson, 494,104. Out of 988,295 votes, he had won by 87, less than 0.01%. Chapter 14. Lists of Names. Lyndon Johnson had won the election. Now he had to keep it won, and that was to be very difficult. For Coke Stevenson believed Johnson had stolen the election, and Stevenson decided to prove he had stolen it. When the 200 new Johnson votes from Luis Salas's Precinct 13 in Jim Wells County were reported on Friday afternoon, Stevenson exploded. "A concentrated effort is being made to count me out of this Senate race," he said in a press release. On Thursday at noon, when the Election Bureau was reporting that he, Stevenson, was 381 votes ahead, and after the Bureau's manager had said that there was little doubt that he had won, Johnson had issued a victory statement and urged his friends to do their duty. Almost immediately, last-minute gains for my opponent began to roll in from those counties of South Texas which are said to be dominated by a single man. I would like to know how my opponent knew so much in advance of the revisions being made today. Johnson's response came fast, too fast. No revisions had been made, he said in a written statement. The explanation for the changes from the South Texas counties was simply that incorrect figures had originally been reported to the Election Bureau, and that the correct figures had not been reported for some time. He had known the correct figures all along, he said. The corrected votes in several of the counties which the Election Bureau has just used were reported to our headquarters Saturday night, August 28th, the night of the election. He had, he said, known ever since election night that he had won. This statement did not help his case. As the Dallas News commented, the Duval County election chairman had announced on Sunday morning, August 29th, that the ballots in Duval's last box, the box that was to turn out to contain 425 votes for Johnson and two for Stevenson, had not yet even been counted. How then could Johnson have known on Saturday night what the count would be? 2 days later, Johnson made a statewide radio broadcast. In the final moments before he went on the air, he sat hunched over the microphone, editing and re-editing the text. During the 8 minutes he spoke, the last 2 minutes were reserved for his wife, he changed his earlier statement. Now he said he had known the correct figures not since Saturday night, but since Tuesday night, August 31st. Then, shifting from defense to offense, he said, "The hue and cry about Duval County has taken so many, many years to develop." Many of Texas's most renowned senators and governors had received Duval's overwhelming vote over the years. Coke Stevenson had. Each of the previous 4 times, Stevenson had run for office. And neither Stevenson nor anyone else had ever complained before. "My opponent has accepted that vote," he said. "The newspapers have complacently reported the vote from the county year after year." If Stevenson had evidence that votes had been bought in Duval, it was his duty to present it to the grand jury. Lyndon Johnson did not buy anybody's vote. Furthermore, he said, similar charges could be made about many counties which Stevenson had carried throughout the state. This argument, that the Valley's vote for Lyndon Johnson was nothing more than the normal run of Texas politics, was always to be Johnson's contention, and it was to be stated and restated over the years by Johnson's supporters, most notably Mary Rather, Walter Jenkins, and Charles Herring. Evaluating this contention is made difficult by the conditions of Texas election records for earlier decades. In the case of lopsided elections, the votes in some counties are not even on record, either because the counties didn't report them or because the state, with the conclusion already sealed, didn't record them. Sufficient records are available, however, for analysis of the previous 14 senatorial and gubernatorial elections, every such election since 1932, and for those elections, Johnson's contention is not correct. In part, the differences between the 1948 election and the earlier elections were only differences of timing and degree. Late amendments of returns were indeed, as Johnson said, common in Texas elections, but not this late. Johnson's 41 race for the Senate, in which both candidates tried to outsteal each other, had been marked by corrected returns, but the bulk of these returns for the Saturday election had been reported to the Election Bureau on Monday, mostly by county officials who excused even this much delay by claiming that no counting of returns had been done on the Sunday Sabbath. By late Monday, the election was in fact over, and the decisive votes were announced as soon as the Election Bureau opened Tuesday morning. Even that degree of lateness had been considered shocking. And now, 7 years later, the decisive votes had come in not on Monday or Tuesday, but on Friday, 6 days after the election. One-sidedness, noticeably heavy votes for one candidate or another, was also common in late corrected returns in Texas, but not this one-sided. The 1941 Senate race is typical. The corrections which gave Papio Daniel the victory came from East Texas, and while the corrections shifted the trend in those counties, the shifts had at least a tinge of plausibility to them. The election night returns from a typical county, Shelby, for example, had been 46% for Congressman Martin Dies, 34% for O'Daniel, 11% for Johnson, and 9% for Gerald Mann. After the 256 new votes reported from Shelby on Monday, the county's total percentages were Dies 44%, O'Daniel 38%, Johnson 10%, Mann 8%. This shift of percentages had enabled O'Daniel to pick up 162 votes on Johnson, but in an inconspicuous manner. The shifts in other counties followed the same pattern. There were no countywide totals for O'Daniel anywhere comparable to 4,622-40. And while these differences were only of timing and degree, there was a crucial third element that, when combined with the first two, made Lyndon Johnson's 1948 senatorial campaign something new in Texas politics. This was the fact that the unusually, perhaps unprecedentedly, one-sided votes which were decisive in Johnson's victory were cast at the direction of a single man, a man who, moreover, did not have to vote 'em but simply to count 'em, which meant that he could provide a candidate with additional votes simply by filling in new numbers on the printed tally sheets provided for a county's returns. This factor, combined with the timing with which these votes were reported, at the last minute after virtually all other votes had been recorded, to narrow the 1948 election in its final decisive stage down to a single border boss waiting for a telephone call, and when he received it, determining the outcome of an election by simply writing down whatever new numbers were required. Johnson's contention that his vote from the Valley was nothing more than normal Texas politics ignores this crucial point. The reason that there had been no hue and cry over the Duval County or South Texas vote for many, many years was that for many years that vote had not played a decisive or even a significant role in any senatorial or gubernatorial election. Coke Stevenson now declared that Johnson's statement was not true. "This is the first instance in recorded history that those block voting counties have determined the result of a statewide election," he said. "And beyond that, this is the first time that the manipulators of the voting in these counties were not content with all-out block voting, but reopened the boxes in secret long after the election had closed and stuffed them with a directed number of ballots." More than a score of Texas politicians who were active in the 1930s and 40s, interviewed in recent years, unanimously disagreed with Johnson's contention, as do the only two surviving intimates of Coke Stevenson from the campaign, Ernest Boyette and Bob Murphy. More tellingly, the only three surviving members of the Johnson campaign's high command, John B. Connally, who would later be governor of Texas, Edward A. Clark, who was for decades an immensely powerful figure in state politics, and George R. Brown, bankroller of scores of Texas elections, do not agree with it either. "Valley votes had never before been decisive in a statewide election," John Connally says. "Never. Never before 1948. Says Ed Clark, "I never did know of a situation like that. I just never did know of anything that was similar to what was happening down there in that area in 1948. And they explained why. The unprecedented size of the par-delivered vote in 1948 and the timing of the delivery. Over the years, Clark says, a lot of different people had been given top-heavy majorities down there, but these majorities had never been given after the votes had been reported. See, down there, one of the questions that was often asked when five or six good friends got together, you understand, was, does that fellow vote 'em, or does he just count 'em? And if he just counted 'em," Clark explains, "and could go on counting them after the election had been over for some days, he could decide the result of any close statewide election just by counting more as needed." Edgar Shelton, after talking to his father, who was George Parr's lawyer, and to the George Parr intimates with whom his father put him in touch, had seen in 1946 the possible dangers of those Valley machines. "What," Shelton asked, "if we had two men running for an important office such as senator or governor, one of them being dishonest? Assume that the dishonest man had secured a pledge of support from the bosses of the Valley, as he probably would. If the race were close and the honest man was ahead by only a few thousand votes with all of the returns in except from the Valley, the election could easily be stolen by having the Valley counties send in just enough votes to put the dishonest man in office. Thus the will of the people of the state would be denied by less than a dozen men, all political feudal lords of the Valley." This, Shelton wrote in 1946, has probably not yet happened. Every long-time Texas politician interviewed agrees that before 1948, it probably never had. Not even the most arrogant border dictator had ever dared to do that, they say. Indeed, when 2 days after Election Day in 1941, Lyndon Johnson had asked George Parr to do precisely that, Parr had refused because his county's overwhelming majority for Johnson had already been recorded. He was later to tell friends that he had replied, "Lyndon, I've been to the federal penitentiary, and I'm not going back for you." Clark says, "I just never saw... Now, there have been other close contests, but," he says, "never one in which there had been a feeling that a result might be changed by an investigation of those controlled counties." In addition, Clark ridicules the theory that Stevenson aides were also stealing votes on a widespread scale throughout the state. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.